friends, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, the United States of war, racist and genocidal to the core.
It's a particularly genocidal kind of warfare that the U.S. military embarks upon in its conquest of lands across North America. Racism underlying U.S. wars has remained a feature of U.S. wars to this day. The vast majority of wars the U.S. military has fought have been against people of color around the world.
No country is too small and weak not to be deemed a threat by the U.S. or Canada. Consider little Haiti.
If Haiti can get away with not following the rules, as weak and impoverished as it is, if we can't tell them what to do, then, you know, we're in a problem. And if Haiti starts breaking away, then maybe Guatemala starts getting a little bit more uppity, and then Honduras, and next thing you got Mexico, and the whole system sort of starts unraveling. That's the logic in which the U.S. Empire and Canada supporting that treats Haiti.
This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Help us deliver this weekly package of Earth news. Subscribe at greenplanetmonitor.net. An astonishing fact. In the 248 years since the United States of America became an independent republic, the U.S. has only been at peace for about 11. The United States of War, you could call it. David Vine does. Vine, a professor of anthropology at American University in Washington, D.C., has recently completed the third in a trilogy of books about Washington's fondness for permanent war and about the role military bases play in its warfighting pursuits across North America at first, then around the world. The GPM reached David Vine in California. When did America start to establish bases off its east and west coasts?
U.S. expansion beyond the North American continent itself begins around the mid-19th century with the seizure acquisition of small islands, mostly for birdshit, guano, which was an important fertilizer of the time. But it's really in 1898, around 1898, in the last decade of the 19th century, that one sees a major expansion beyond the continent. Of course, with the seizure of Hawaii, the conquest of the Hawaiian monarchy with the help of the Dole corporate interests and other colonists from the mainland United States who helped encourage the U.S. government to seize Hawaii formally. And then the War of 1898 with Spain, where one sees the United States defeat the dissolving Spanish Empire and seize colonies in Puerto Rico, in the Caribbean, as well as a de facto colony in Cuba, and then colonies in the Philippines and Guam. Around the same time, the U.S. government seizes American Samoa, where people still have a kind of fourth-class U.S. citizenship. The people living in all the colonies don't have the citizenship rights that people like I have living in California. And then there's continued conquest. And in the case of the U.S. Virgin Islands, the United States government buys the Virgin Islands from Denmark during World War I. And then it is, as my book shows, in World War II itself, and then continuing into the post-World War II period, one sees the creation of a collection of U.S. military bases abroad that is larger than that of any people, country, or empire in world history, a collection of foreign extraterritorial bases larger than that of any empire in world history. And this begins during the war, with thousands of base sites around the world that the U.S. military occupies, frequently built with the labor of locals, the low paid, if that, labor of locals. And then it becomes an infrastructure of bases that remains in place throughout the Cold War period and to this day. While the total number of bases shrunk after the war, there is a permanent infrastructure of bases that the U.S. government has maintained since World War II that has expanded and contracted in various ways. Most dramatically, of course, the collection of bases has expanded in the greater Middle East in the period really since the 1980s and the enunciation of the Carter Doctrine, which President Reagan then followed. And this infrastructure of bases in the Middle East has been a critical part of what made it all too easy for U.S. leaders to lead the country into disastrous wars against Iraq and Afghanistan in particular, but equally disastrous wars in Libya, Yemen, Somalia, and beyond.
And many of these bases are situated on islands. There are all these island bases, like American Samoa, Puerto Rico, Hawaii, Guam, the U.S. Virgin Islands, Okinawa, Guantanamo Base in Cuba, Johnston Atoll, Kwajalein Atoll. There are all these islands, and then there's Diego Garcia, of course. There are all these islands which were and are perfect places to build bases, and they're just like the forts of the Western United, well, all around the United States. These bases kind of serve two roles: to project American military power and influence, but also economic power. They're way stations for commercial shipping and the rest of it. And all these, many of these islands, their bases were established through the dispossession of people. People were driven off these islands.
Indeed, the base on Diego Garcia, which, as I mentioned, was how I, in many ways, came to this work, the base where in the late 1960s and early 1970s, the U.S. government, again with the help of the British government, forcibly displaced the entire Chagossian people and dumped them in exile.
The Chagossian people, they're called.
Chagossian people, yeah, the people of the Chagos Islands in the middle of the Indian Ocean. This history, the way in which the Chagossians suffered, tells a much bigger story of how the U.S. empire has worked in the post-World War II era.
Get into that in a little bit of detail.
Yeah, islands have become increasingly important as a way to project U.S. military power and U.S. economic power, rather than seizing large swaths of territory in the post-World War II era, the era of decolonization, when the U.S. government supported at least some, but definitely not all, decolonization efforts. The United States government, its leaders, military and political leaders, saw islands as a key way to maintain U.S. influence and control around the world, to deploy the U.S. military, but also to exert economic and political forms of influence and power.
And so Diego Garcia, talk about specifically Diego Garcia and the Chagossians.
So Diego Garcia is exemplary of this strategy, what U.S. Navy personnel, officers described as a strategic island concept. And that's the concept that led to the creation of a base on Diego Garcia and leads to the investigation of U.S. military bases being built on islands around the globe. And it becomes a justification for maintaining key U.S. bases in places like Guam and elsewhere around the world. U.S. leaders looked for islands that were lightly populated, where they could either displace the local people or not have to worry about them, and from which the U.S. military could build bases and then project power. Diego Garcia, again, is symbolic.
It's right in the middle of the Indian Ocean.
Yeah, it's far from virtually everywhere. It's 1,000 miles due south of India and halfway between Africa and Indonesia. So it's far from everywhere, but also relatively close to a large swath of the globe, from southern Africa to the Middle East to South Asia and East Asia, which meant for the U.S. military that it became a place from which they could project air and naval power in particular, and threaten the likes of now China and Iran. The base on Diego Garcia became a key launch pad for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
And how many people were living on Diego Garcia? How many Chagossians were there, and what happened to them?
So at the time, there were about 1,500 to 2,000 Chagossians.
And they just drove them out. They just said, you're getting out.
Precisely. The history of how the Chagossians were displaced 1,200 miles away to the western Indian Ocean islands of Mauritius and the Seychelles is complicated. It took place over about 5 years. Initially, people were prevented from going home when they were left for vacations or medical care. Later, they were herded onto overcrowded cargo ships and deported 1,200 miles away. In the process, on Diego Garcia, as people were awaiting their deportation, U.S. military personnel and British government agents herded all the Chagossians' pet dogs into sealed cargo sheds, where they then proceeded to gas them with the exhaust from U.S. Navy vehicles, and then burned the carcasses of Chagossians' pet dogs as the Chagossians looked on. And as one of the Chagossians' lawyers has pointed out, this sent a pretty strong message about what might happen if the Chagossians resisted their deportation. Of course, Chagossians have resisted. They protested being deported at the time, and since they arrived in exile, they have protested and demanded the right to go home. And they've been leading a very long struggle, now more than 50 years in exile, demanding the U.S. and British governments allow them to go back home. Britain was involved because it claimed Diego Garcia and the other Chagos Islands as a colony. And in fact, at the suggestion of U.S. government officials, Britain created its last colony, its last created colony that they called the British Indian Ocean Territory. And this enabled the creation of the base and the deportation of the Chagossians. In recent years, the International Court of Justice and the UN have said that this creation of a new colony in the era of decolonization was unlawful, and that Mauritius, the government of independent Mauritius, is the lawful sovereign over the Chagos Islands. So this was very encouraging for the Chagossians. They supported the Mauritian government's case at the International Court of Justice. And now it looks like Chagossians are closer to going home than they've been in 50 years. But they're still not home. There are negotiations underway now between the United Kingdom and Mauritius, where we also know that the U.S. government is playing a key behind-the-scenes role in those negotiations. But the Chagossians are still demanding justice, and we hope that they will be home sometime soon.
David Vine is a professor of anthropology at American University in Washington, D.C., and the author of a trilogy of books about permanent war as an American way of life, The United States of War, A Global History of America's Endless Conflicts, From Columbus to the Islamic State, was published in 2020 by University of California Press. Listen to my complete conversation with David Vine at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, please subscribe. With your help, we'll keep delivering stories about Earth systems, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. About tiny islands coveted, invaded by, and oppressed by Washington and its Western allies, consider little Haiti. Columbus landed there on his first voyage in 1492. Haiti became a Spanish colony. In 1697, Spain ceded it to the French, who turned it into a slave colony, reaping tons of sugarcane and massive wealth for the freedom-loving French. In 1791, a former slave, Toussaint Louverture, launched a revolt. His successor, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, defeated Napoleon, declaring Haitian independence in 1804, the second free republic in the Americas. Clearly a threat to the first free republic in the Americas, Haiti's far larger and more powerful slave-based neighbor to the north. Throughout the 19th century, U.S. gunboats invaded Haitian waters on numerous occasions, seeking access to Mole Saint-Nicolas, a protected harbor on Haiti's northwest tip, the perfect place to establish a naval base and coaling station. U.S. troops occupied Haiti from 1915 to 1934, protecting U.S. corporate interests. Powerful U.S., French, and Canadian corporations would take their place, reaping profits from Haitian natural resources and cheap labor in alliance with local white elites and the dictatorial dynasty of François Duvalier and his son. Baby Doc was deposed in 1986. Compliant regimes followed, punctuated by popular governments that inevitably displeased France, the U.S., of course, and Canada. Haiti's current turmoil began in July 2021, following the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse. Moïse's successor, Ariel Henry, has now been booted out in violent street campaigns led by heavily armed street gangs. Anti-imperialist, the most powerful Haitian gangster calls himself. To learn more about all this, the GPM spoke with Yves Engler. Engler is a Montreal-based writer and political commentator with a great interest in Haiti. We reached Yves Engler in Montreal. Can you quickly run through for me, Yves, what U.S., Canadian, and French interests are in Haiti and why they aren't working to help the Haitians develop a sustainable government and society of their own?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the first part, when you look at U.S. imperialism in the hemisphere, which, as you mentioned, is well established, it was always most brutal in Haiti, right? The U.S. occupation of Haiti was 20, the formal occupation was 20 years, 1915 to 34. Just before the occupation, the year before, the U.S. Marines marched into Port-au-Prince and took all of the gold in the central bank of Haiti in Port-au-Prince. The formal occupation didn't begin U.S. imperialism. That began decades and decades before. And then U.S. troops left, they kept control of the treasury for another decade. So when we talk about, you know, the brutality of U.S. imperialism in Central America, it's two or three times more intense in Haiti. It's been historically and continues to be. Now, the interest question is a complicated one, and it's almost always what people want to ask. And we did this when we did this book tour. We did like 30 or 40 events on this Canada and Haiti book in 2005. We, in our talk, we included what we considered part of the why question. And then invariably, in every single talk, despite including that, someone asked why. Why would Canada do this?
And now you're talking about why Canada would do it.
Why Canada? Yeah. And so now we get into some simple questions. Well, first, I'll just go start with the French. Okay, so the French interest in 2004 was pretty straightforward, right? The Aristide government, on the 200th anniversary of Haitian independence, or in the lead up to the 200th anniversary of Haitian independence, which was January 1st, 2004, the government instigated a formal process for restitution.
The French government.
To the French government for the, often called the debt of independence, but really was a ransom, where Haitians were forced to pay for the lost property, the French lost property that came with the Haitian Revolution. Now, of course, the lost property was two main things, was the land that the Haitian anti-slave revolt ended up with, that became Haitian country, and the people, the slaves, right? That was the lost property of the slave owners. So Haitians not only won their independence, this incredibly brutal war that half of the population was killed, and 13 years they defeated slavery, they defeated the French Empire, the Americans that helped at one point, the Spanish, the British, they defeated the three main empires of the world of the day. And of course, it was a massive blow to white supremacy and a huge, huge boost to anti-slavery forces everywhere in the world, really. I mean, it was just a massive, massive step forward for the concept of, human equality. Huge effects. I mean, the Louisiana Purchase, right? France sells all of the big chunk of the south of the U.S. To Washington because they're defeated in Haiti. So, then later on, the Haitians provide the decisive support for Miranda and the Bolivar, the liberation of South America. So the Haitian Revolution is this incredibly important historical moment, multi-year moment. So that's part of it. And so after that, two decades after the revolution is successful in Haiti independence, the French, they are strong, in a stronger position, and they basically send gunboats and to Haiti and say, if you don't pay us for our lost property, we're going to invade. And it was a more compliant government in place in Port-au-Prince, and they basically agree. And it takes 122 years for Haiti to pay off this debt of independence. In the late 1800s, 50, 60 years after they begin the payments, it's more than half of Haiti's GDP, or more than half of the government's budget, is being devoted to debt payments to France for lost property. So in the lead up to 2004, the Aristide government tabulates what they consider to be the cost of this debt of independence. And they come up with what is now considered a very conservative estimate of $21 billion. Their subsequent investigation, New York Times, said it's actually probably more likely it should have been closer to $40 billion.
So in 2004, when Aristide put forward that claim, the Haitians had paid off their debt to the French?
Yeah, they paid it off in 1947.
And now they wanted the money back.
Yeah, they want to be repayment. And this isn't a compensation for the enslavement, right? That's a whole other thing that Haitians could make a very legitimate claim to the French government to, for the crimes that you of enslaving us, taking us from Africa, all the massacres, et cetera, et cetera. This is just for a payment that the Haitian government made to the French for defeating their enslavement. And so the French government had a very clear interest, and this had some legal foundation. It was just straightforward, right? Right after the coup government, they just dropped the whole pursuit of the French for this financial claim.
So was this the reason for the coup in the overthrow of Aristide?
This was a contributing factor for sure. There's no doubt. The New York Times just about a year ago, the French ambassador at the time admitted to the New York Times, yes, that contributed to ousting Aristide. And in that New York Times piece, the French ambassador at the time basically admitted it was a coup. And we have now a couple of Canadian officials in the very good documentary series on Canadian foreign policy. The Canadian minister at the time basically sort of admitted that Canada helped oust Aristide, called Aristide a big man, and sort of framed it was all Aristide's fault and this kind of stuff.
But what was Canada's interest in joining in with the French and the Americans? And what were the Americans' interests, and what was Canada's interest?
Different ways to look at that one. The first way to look at that is that Canada has supported, as Owen Schock and I point out in a new book, Canada supported more than 20 coups since the 1950s, right? From Mossadegh in Iran, Pinochet in Chile, to Lumumba, even Manuel Zelaya in Honduras in 2009. So Canada has this long history of supporting U.S.-backed coups throughout the hemisphere. This is not an aberration. We don't hear about it in the major media, but this fits with a pattern of Canadian foreign policy. And that's what Owen Schock and I argue in our latest book, Canada's Long Fight Against Democracy.
Because Canada's economic interests, the interests of Canadian economic elites, is basically intimately intertwined with the interests of American corporate elites.
That's an important part of it. I would say there's two different ways to look at that one. Bill Graham, who was then the defense minister, he admitted in a 2007 book about Afghanistan that, as he put it, when we came, they had not formally joined the U.S. invasion of Iraq. They supported that in different ways, but I'll leave that aside for the moment. But they hadn't formally joined the Bush administration coalition of the willing. And so, as he put it in the 2007 book about Afghanistan, we got another arrow in our quiver for getting on board with the U.S. coup in Haiti. So there's two parts playing out there. There's one part where there's the U.S. puts pressure on Canada to join a coup process in the case of Haiti in 2004. But then there's the other part that you're highlighting, which is the question of the Canadian elite see the world and profit from the world in a very similar way to the U.S. elite. And to get into the concrete of that, in Haiti, they were angry with the Haitian government around Canadian mining concession. And of course, Canada is the global powerhouse in international mining. Aristide, back actually when he was out of office, but there was a Canadian company that tried to extract, and there was peasant resistance in the late 90s. And Aristide was seen as siding with the sort of popular opposition to this mining firm. At one point, a Canadian mining company had prospecting rights for 10% of all of Haitian territory. As the company that was angry with Aristide was called Saint-Geneviève. It was a company here in Montreal. But the more substantive economic interest that Canada has in Haiti is the sweatshops. Okay, so Gildan Activewear, which is a Montreal-based company, it was the second biggest employer in Haiti after the state at around the time of the coup. And its lead subcontractor was André Appède. André Appède was the head of the group of 184, light-skinned guy, basically a white guy in Haitian context, of Middle Eastern descent, who led this group of 184 opposition to Aristide. This was the civil, quote-unquote, civil society opposition to Aristide. And he was a top sweatshop owner in the country. And when Aristide doubled the minimum wage, that, of course, angered the sweatshop interests. And Gildan had something like 8,000 employees, indirect and direct employees at one point. So from the standpoint of North American capitalism, what Haiti is, what they would like Haiti to be, is basically a place where Black women make $5 a day sewing T-shirts or baseballs or, you know, whatever, products like that for the North American market. And that was kind of what they had succeeded in turning Haiti into under the Jean-Claude Duvalier dictatorship, when there was about 30,000 people in the Port-au-Prince region that were basically doing sweatshop work. So that's the model that Haiti kind of provides. Now, tied in with that is the fact that Haiti plays this role in driving down wages in the hemisphere, right? So basically, it's like if the workers in Honduras or Guatemala get a bit uppity, we can be like, oh, well, we can always ship stuff to Haiti where it's, you know, we can pay them half of what we're paying, you know, the $10 a day in Honduras. And Gildan Active were actually very concretely like that. Their biggest operations are in Honduras. So Haiti provides sort of like the, you know, it's the bottom of the barrel in the race to the bottom when it comes to wages and, you know, hyper exploitation. So that's an important part of understanding Haiti in a kind of global capitalist perspective. But I think the maybe the simpler understanding is this is just like, this is just power. This is the U.S. empire saying that Haiti is irrelevant from a standpoint of economic interests. You know, the Haiti's entire economy is equivalent to like a big Canadian university. Like McGill's entire budget is probably almost what, or McGill and Concordia together is probably what all of the Haitian economy is, right? Haiti's economy today is basically, you know, a third of it comes just from remittances from people abroad. So it's fairly limited value from a capitalist perspective. But from the standpoint of the U.S. empire, the standpoint of viewing this from, to take Chomsky's analogy, the mafia don, if Haiti can get away with not following the rules, as weak and impoverished as it is, if you have this sort of famille Lavalas Aristide government that won't just like succumb to whatever we want and you know, has this kind of like pro-poor, a sovereigntist kind of perspective, if we can't tell them what to do, then, you know, we're in a problem. And while Haiti might not matter much from North American capitalist perspective, if Haiti starts breaking away, then maybe Guatemala starts getting a little bit more uppity, and then that matters a bit more to U.S. capitalism, and then Honduras, the next thing you got Mexico, and the whole system sort of starts unraveling. That's the logic in which I think the U.S. empire and Canada supporting that treats Haiti. Now, then there's this other, whole other thing that kind of should be understood to sort of fit the bigger picture, kind of wraps it all, which is the whole punishing Haiti for what it did 200 and some odd years ago. I think it's really hard for North Americans, obviously particularly white North Americans, to kind of wrap their head around the idea that, yeah, like in 2004, Canada was going to send troops to Haiti to like punish it for winning independence against slavery 200 years ago. It all kind of seems a little out there. It's a position that most Haitians have believed to some extent. And I think it's clearly correct to some extent. There's this deep-seated anti-Haitianism. And it obviously has an important component that's racism towards Black people. It's anti-Black. But it actually has a kind of also has a component that's anti-Haitians particular. And you see it, of course, in the Dominican Republic and in other, even, you know, largely Black Caribbean countries, where they really adopt this anti-Haitianism. And the concrete part of that, you know, you see, well, the U.S. refused to recognize Haiti until slavery was abolished. So it took 60 years for the U.S. to recognize Haiti. And they said it clearly at the time that we can't recognize this country run by former slaves, while we have, you know, well, black people in the U.S. are enslaved. So there's been this long